Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another Wednesday night edition on the Fight Network. We're going to be talking sports as we always do every Wednesday night. Number of guests all around the country. We've got some great guests tonight, one being Jim Cott, one of the great pitchers just installed into the Hall of Fame. Jim's going to be chatting with us in the next half hour, but we're going to start off as we always do with Roy Cummings. And obviously, everybody knows that we've got people all around Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and, of course, Tampa, Florida. We'll start with Roy. And, Roy, even though it's spring training, the last couple of days have seen some very, very big signings. One by the Philadelphia Phillies, they got their number one guy. And the San Francisco Giants, who were rumored going to sign Chapman, did, in fact, sign Chapman to a number of years, but also with the opportunity to play out if he decides to. Some of your thoughts on those two signings and some of the other ones you might want to talk about.
Yeah, I think the Chapman one is really big for the Giants. I mean, they kind of needed a superstar caliber bat in that lineup, certainly a power bat in that lineup, and they get that out of Chapman, you know, as long as he can, you know, find that groove again. I mean, it really wasn't there a year ago, but you know, the defense is special too, and that's important. So, and you know what, again, it's a favorable deal for the team. If Matt Chapman can't, you know, if he can't get back to the level he was at a few years ago with the Giants, you know, he can walk away. The team's kind of on the hook, but, there's a good chance for him to resolve things there and play at the level he's expected to. And, well, how can you not be excited about Zach Wheeler being back with the Phillies? I mean, this guy has been an absolute workhorse for this team. Really been, you know, just solid. I mean, just a steady arm in that rotation that you can count on, and every fifth day to give you a good solid start. And, you know, the Phillies are starting to look pretty good. You know, Bryce Harper's looking more and more comfortable every day at first base. They got some depth in the lineup now at catcher in particular. Certainly got, you know, a lot of options in the outfield where you can, you know, put some defensive pieces in late for, you know, in left field and right field for Castellanos and Schwarber. I like the way they're looking. You know, they look really good. And, you know, I think they're going to give the Braves a good run once again. So good signings all around, in my opinion. I think things are starting to come together for everybody in Major League Baseball.
Roger, they sort of sat back, waiting to sign Wheeler to see what he was going to be able to do or what they were going to be able to do and match up with what everybody wanted to get. But very, very good news for the Phillies. Their starting pitching rotation really in pretty good shape. The backside, a little bit of a question mark, but they've got plenty of bodies to work with, and maybe they'll come up with a four or five that are outstanding as well.
Well, I think they're set. I mean, with four and five, you know, as we talked about last week with Howard Eskin, you know, I think that what they're set up for. Howard said this for quite a while. And I don't know, you know, Roy, I don't, you know, you probably don't hear Howard like Frank, Don and I do, but he has said that he didn't expect the Phillies to win this year, but he does expect them to really do well and possibly and a good shot to win next year, because what's going to happen is the pitchers that they have in the rotation, other than maybe the top two or three, they're going to have the good farm hands that are going to be ready physically and also experience wise to come in, and so they're building for the future too. But I agree with you, the Phillies look good, and I don't think that they're finished yet. I think they may make another move, especially for the bullpen.
Well, I agree with that. Excuse me, but I also think, the Braves right now, over the last few years, have been the dominant team in the National League East. Of course, the Dodgers overall in the National League have been really the dominant team. But, Roy, let's get to your bailiwick, which is the National Hockey League. And Coop's trying very, very hard, but in that 4-5 spot right now, and it's very, very difficult for them to put together a little bit of a winning streak and put some pressure on the other teams heading up for the playoffs.
Yeah, you're right. And I think right now, I think the game plan in Tampa in terms of the Lightning, I think is pretty simple. It's stay healthy and just stay in the race. You know, they've got a fairly comfortable edge right now on the teams that are chasing them for that last wild card spot. I don't think they're going to get a divisional spot. I think they're going to end up being a wild card. That could change. I mean, they're good enough certainly to change that if somebody hits a slump and, hey, you know, Boston suddenly slumped a little bit. I think the real concern there is just get in. And because they know that. I mean, they know it as well as anybody. Just get in. And, you know, sometimes you get a favorable matchup early on and, you beat a team and you get some momentum going your way. So I think the key here is, just stay healthy, get into the race. I mean, they made they were involved in a minor trade today. I mean, they had Adam Henrique for the time he would take you to drink a cup of coffee, and then they moved him to Edmonton for a fourth round draft pick. So, you know, they're starting to make some moves. They don't have a lot of cap space they can really take on, so I don't know how much more they can do for their team. But they're in a comfortable spot, you know, in that wild card situation. The problem is they only got, what, 18 games left after tonight, and most everybody around them has 21 or 22 or, you know, left after tonight. So 3-4 games out of hand, not in hand, it hurts them. It gives everybody else, you know, the Islanders, Capitals, take your pick, a chance to catch up. And
right.
That could happen again. So the Lightning don't really have much room for, you know, for error here. And as I said, it's not a deep team. They're somewhat prone to error because if they get hurt, they're going to have some issues. So we'll see how it goes, and teams are starting to make moves around them. Florida just picked up Vladimir Tarasenko from Ottawa. Buffalo's moving some players here and there. The Flyers, which did something today that I did not think they were going to do when they got rid of Sean Walker, a right-handed defenseman, part of that Nick Seeler-Sean Walker tandem there, that pairing, which has been so good for the Flyers this year. But boy, oh boy, did they cash in on that. I mean, you get Ryan Johansson back, who'll probably be a third-line center for them, maybe a second line, but gives the Flyers depth at center. And they get a first-round pick. Granted, it's conditional, but they get a first-round pick out of that for a kid who's absolutely one of the best stories in the NHL. Sean Walker, not drafted in junior, not drafted in the NHL, ended up going to college, went to Bowling Green, got himself noticed, and continued to be noticed as he started to make his way through the pro ranks a little bit, and has had an exceptional year. Right-handed shot defenseman, hard to find. Defensive-oriented player, a little bit of, you know, just a tad of offensive skill. Smart kid, smart player, and going to be tough to see him go and tough to see him get moved. But I think there's another move in store here for the Flyers. Don't be surprised. I've heard Jacob Chychrun's name thrown around a little bit. If you can end up, you know, trading Sean Walker away, getting Ryan Johansson a first-round pick, and then somehow still get Jacob Chychrun, well, you're a better team for it. So we'll see where it goes. You know, there's no guarantee. A lot of teams want Chychrun, but at the end of the day, Flyers starting to make some moves too. I think they're still in it. I think they still feel like they can. I think they're going to be buyers more than sellers, really, here.
Roy, I could not agree with you more. At the same time, Roger, in the Metropolitan Division, the Rangers are right there on top and are playing very, very solid hockey and have been. Hit a little bit of a slump a week and a half ago, but they've certainly gotten out of that. New York is very concerned about whether they're going to make a trade at the trading deadline. Most of the writers in New York are saying, do not make a trade, hold where you are. But at the same time, the Rangers doing a nice job. And, of course, Philadelphia, as Roy just said, Philadelphia making the climb. We said it would take the coach maybe a year, maybe a year and a half. We've seen what he's done, Roy especially, and when he won the Stanley Cup in Tampa, and it looks like he's moving the Flyers in the right direction. Roger,
Roy?
There?
Oh, I'm here. I thought you were going back to Roy.
He just outlined what he thought. I'm going
well,
to you.
I know. And, yeah, well, I agree. And it's funny, ironically, I work with a woman that a husband went to Bowling Green. I guess they both did. And she, I wish I was there today to talk to her about this because they are huge hockey fans. So it's always great discussion. Yeah, but you know what? We talk about the tort. But also, you got to give a lot of credit to Danny Briere and Keith Jones. Okay, they have they're the ones that got it all together, and they said that Jonesy said from day one that they were not only working for now, they're looking for the future. And you know, to build a program, you have to definitely have commitment. And I think they've got the commitment from the new head of Comcast Spectacor, which there was some concern. You know, after Ed Snyder passed away, everything changed because the Flyers would probably not have been in the position they were if Ed Snyder was still involved. And but they are. They have played 63 games. They're 32-23 with 8 overtimes, total points of 72. And that's tough because the Rangers are at 84, but they're in position for the playoffs. And I think that that's a big step forward.
Well, I think you mentioned Torque too, and Roy certainly knows him well from being in Tampa. But I think he's doing it a little bit quicker than most people thought he could do it. I know the league is now spread out so much. A couple of key moves will move you up to the middle of the pack or maybe a little bit ahead. But I just think Torque's done another great. He had a shaky first year last year, but he's coming on strong this year.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it has happened a little bit sooner than even Torch thought, certainly than the Flyers thought. I mean, when you make as many changes as the Flyers have made, with upper management in the last 2 years, it's hard to expect immediate results, but that's pretty much what they're getting. And look, you know what? That goes to the players. That's a result of the players buying in immediately to what John Tortorella wants to do. You know, usually the first year or two under a new coach is a feeling out period. Who fits my scheme? Who can I use here? Who can we get rid of? Who's valuable to us the way we play the game now? But I think Torch has figured that out in a hurry, and I think a lot of guys decided, you know what, I'm ready to play for this guy. Yeah, it's going to be a little bit more difficult than it might be for some other coaches. He's demanding, but you know what? One thing that you don't go to Philadelphia, you know, you're not going to be you're going to be a lunch pail guy when you go to Philadelphia, just especially in hockey. That's who you're going to be. You're going to be a black and blue type player. You're going to bang people. You're going to work hard in the corners, work hard along the boards, block shots. And I think the Flyers got away from that. And now under John Tortorella, they're looking more like what we have always thought the Flyers to be, which is one of those lunch pail gangs that, they're gonna make it hard for you every night, and that's what they're doing. And the key to it all is the fact that the players have bought in. And you know, even without Corey Hart now, goaltending a little bit of a question mark, but they love Ersan, and they think he can be a number one. And wouldn't surprise me to see if they picked up a goalie. They do have room. I mean, they could certainly add on pieces here, and they're gonna have to continue to do that, I think, because the Rangers aren't sitting by idly, guys. It didn't happen while we were talking. It happened before that, but they picked up Alex Wenberg from Seattle. So that replaces the injured Philip Hedel, who's gone. Blake Wheeler's gone in New York. They're out for the season. So you bring in Alex Wenberg, and you certainly replace those guys. So the Rangers aren't giving up. They're going to continue to build onto that team, which is already as good a team as there is in the league. So. We'll see where it goes. It's going to be a fight down to the finish, that's for sure. And I'll tell you what, it's going to be fun because the three teams right now that are fighting for that top spot in the Metropolitan, the Rangers, Hurricanes, and Flyers, they're good teams. They're very good teams. And you know what? Wouldn't surprise me at all if Philadelphia catches Carolina and moves past them. I think that can still happen.
Right, got to agree on that. But also the same thing has happened with the Rangers. They have been really, since the early part of the season, trying to build, to be more physical, to be a tougher defensive team. And that's exactly what the coaches brought to the game every game they've played so far, even the games they won. You know, he'll say after the game is over, well, yeah, but we were ahead 3-1. We sort of got a little too, we weren't physical enough. I want to see you keep playing all the way. I don't want to see you. They had 3 or 4 to 1 and decide that's a game over. And Roger, you just can't do that in the National Hockey League. You got to keep playing, and that's what they brought to the Rangers this year.
Well, that's true, and you do. And because the thing is, if it goes to a tie and then it goes into a shootout, anything can happen. I mean, yeah, you're going to get
right.
A point, but you just don't know. You know, I was just looking at the standings in the Western Conference, and it's amazing how their point total across the board, other than, when you get down below the, say, the top four, seems to be, higher than in the Eastern Conference. But, Don, you hit the nail on the head. It's not like the old days where you were playing across the board, because I mean, you do, you've got two in the Eastern Conference,
The Panthers are 90 points, Bruins 87, and then you come down and you got the Rangers at 84. Everybody else is in the 70s or below. And I think that's interesting. The point totals differential at the top from the east to west.
Before we switch over to football, I think one of the things, too, is Roy wanted to say something,
Don. Go ahead, Roy.
I was just going to comment on what Roger was saying about the difference in how there's, you know, several teams, more teams, it seems, in the West with higher point totals. And I think the biggest reason for that is it's only over in the West you really have teams that are truly rebuilding. You've got Anaheim that's completely in a rebuild still with a bunch of kids. Arizona's kind of in the same position. Blackhawks for sure. San Jose, which just I'm not sure they know what they're doing right now. And you got a couple of teams that have kind of disappointed this year as well, St. Louis, Minnesota, even Seattle to some degree. So the West is really top-heavy, and it's very light at the bottom. You got five teams there that, you know, people are beating up on a regular basis, whereas in the East, there are no weak teams. There really aren't. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, New Jersey is a team that a lot of people expected a lot of great things from this year. They're still somewhat competitive and over 500, but they're at the bottom. Columbus is really the only team, them and Ottawa. Well, Montreal is rebuilding, but, you know, there's only about two, three teams really in the East that, you know, just aren't really as competitive as they'd like to be right now. And that's one of the reasons you see the difference there. It's just there's about five rebuilding teams in the West, and they just they're just not ready to compete with the Edmontons and Colorados and Dallases and that kind of thing.
I was just going to say, before I went to you, Roy, start with Vancouver and work down. I mean, that's they've been the story in the West all the way through, and somewhere around 84, 85 points, right off the paper in front of me, but 84, 85 points. And then you go from there and look around at the other teams. So when you talk about top heavy, you start at Vancouver, and then you go downhill. They should be a dominant team in the playoffs out there.
Yeah, they should. And with Rick Tocchet in charge, they'll know exactly how to play. You know, one of the problems that Vancouver may have is that they're just not
ex-Flyer, my boy, ex-Flyer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He knows how to do it. knows how you got to bring it in the playoff time. The problem is, that team's not really battle-tested for the playoffs just yet. It could be a bit of a surprise, you know, depending on who they face early on. I mean, I'm still not giving up on the Kings. Certainly not, you know, and Winnipeg could still cause problems. Nashville could still get there, believe it or not. So, you know, but if Vancouver ends up facing somebody like, I don't know, Vegas or Colorado, oh, boy, that's going to be tough. But those playoffs are going to be special. I'll tell you that right now. Those Western Conference playoffs are going to be special, man, because there is not a weak team in that group that's going to be in the playoffs, not a single one.
Not only that, but Roger Vink – Las Vegas continues to, I shouldn't say surprise. I mean, they were surprised their first year expansion, but they just keep going. I mean, it's an amazing thing what they've been able to do as they made that transition out to Vegas as a new ball club in a new area.
Well, you're right, but the team that really shocks me has tradition and, I mean, a history. The Chicago Blackhawks, 37 points. At this point in the season, I mean, what has happened to the Blackhawks? You know, Roy, you're a Chicago guy.
It's a total rebuild. I mean, they got the first overall pick a year ago for a reason. I mean, I wouldn't say they were tanking, but you know, mm-hmm. they changed coaches in midstream last year. They won the lottery. They got fortunate, and they got once they won the lottery, they said, okay, it's time to completely rebuild. I mean, they've got three or four rookies in the lineup, a couple on defense. Korchinski's one of them, Crevier's another, and they have not been afraid to bring up guys from their minor league team and work them into the lineup on a regular basis. You know, they lost Perry, which hurt them a little bit, but I mean, when your top line's got, you know, Foligno and guys like Jason Dickinson on it, you're not going to be competitive. But it's a total rebuild there. But they're also a team that I think probably rebuilds quickly. Again, it's mm-hmm. a tough division, very tough division. But I think they can rebuild quickly because, you know, they got a key piece there, obviously, and and Connor Bedard. And, you know, don't forget, you know, he missed a dozen games with a broken jaw. So, you know, I watch them on a regular basis, and they'll figure it out. They've got they got a lot of young kids, but I think they'll figure it out. There's, as you said, there's a tradition there in Chicago. The fan base is behind the rebuild. They're excited to see this team play because they're an exciting team to play, and they'll get better. They will. They need another draft or two, but they'll be there.
Roy Cummings, thank you very much, as always, for the first segment of the show, and we covered a number of different sports and a number of different items, and I thank you so very, very much, and we'll do it all again next week.
Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Have a great week.
Thanks,
Roy.
I'll
tell you just
bye-bye.
One thing, Don. The Rays beat the Yankees today, so that was a plus today. We didn't get to talk to Roy about that.
Well, let's get on the baseball front right now because we got a Hall of Famer sitting here waiting to chat with us. And Jim Cott, I can tell you this. It's a long time ago when he came to the Phillies, and I remember doing the first interview with him when I was working with the Phillies when he came in. And I'll tell you, it was a great delight the period of time they were. Jim, welcome to the show, and thank you very, very much for joining us. And I also want to say at the top, I want to thank Billy Wendell because I know you were on with him last week, and Billy and I worked together for about 40 years. And he said, Jim Cott would be a great, great guest for you. So I thank Billy for setting it all up for us. Jim, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, Billy put me in touch with my good friend Bill White on the phone for a while last week, which was always nice to talk with Bill, who is 90 years old now. But, yeah, happy to be on with you.
Well, I'll tell you, Bill and I converse once in a while. And before he moved from his home into where he's living today, I'll tell you, Bill was a terrific, terrific guy, and very disappointed that he didn't also get into the Hall of Fame with you. He missed it by one vote, and Bill White is one of the class people of all of baseball. But let's get to some of your career because it was fantastic. I mean, just the number of games that you won, 283 games won, 2,461 strikeouts. But what I want to start the program off with, I want to talk about pitching. And go back to 1960 when you and John Sain got together. Johnny Sain, of course, part of the Atlanta Braves and Milwaukee Braves, Spahn and Sain and Pray for Rain. He was one of the great pitchers. He became a pitching coach. And you met up with him in 1960 when he was pitching coach when you were there. And you said your goal when you started the season was to pitch 40 games, to pitch 280 innings, and to pitch every 4 days. That was your goal. And you and Johnny Sain worked on it. And so tell me about this. This is not the game we're looking at today.
No, that was you. Of course, John, when he pitched with Warren Spahn back in the 40s, and, you know, the game wasn't based on power and young kids chasing velocity then. It was pitching. Pitching was more of an art form than a science experiment where everybody tried to see how hard they could throw and how hard they could maintain it. But so John, you know, reinvented himself in the late 40s, right after World War II, and then became a coach. And gosh, he was so special to me. But he was kind of a believer in it'll rust out before it'll wear out. So he had us throwing the ball every day. And I remember he told Ralph Houk when he went to coach for the Yankees, he said, who's your best pitcher? And of course he said, Whitey Ford. Well, at the time, Whitey was winning like 16 games a year. And John said, well, if he's your best pitcher, wouldn't you want him out there every 4 days, like 40 times a year? Because certainly pitchers are capable of doing that. The arm will recover in about 72 hours. So on that fourth day, you're ready to go again. And lo and behold, Whitey goes 25-4 the next day. So, you know, that's where John built his reputation. And everywhere he went was with Mudcat Grant and then Mickey Lolich, McLean, Wilbur Wood in Chicago. He was a great believer in throwing the baseball as often as you could, which I think, you know, made you feel comfortable on the mound, that your control was good. You just much better than pitching every 5 or 6 days. And if there's a spot in the Hall of Fame for pitching coaches, I think Johnny would be the number one choice.
Well, you tried it for a while too as a pitching coach, but also you and John got together twice. He reinvented you the second time as well when he speeded up your of course your delivery was always pretty quick, but he changed a little bit there, which you said gave you a second life, and you won a lot of games after that.
Yeah, that's what John brought to the table. You know, he wasn't a method guy, but he would look at you and say, well, you know, if I were in your shoes, what would I want to do to improve? And when the Twins put me on waivers, I was coming off a year where I broke my wrist in 1972, sliding into base. So 73, I was pretty spotty. And they put me on waivers, and I was so fortunate that Roland Heeman, general manager of the White Sox, and along with Chuck Tanner and Johnny Sain, said, well, let's get him over here. And so John looked at me, and he said, well, we have to speed up your release. Your arm's just a little bit lazy. And so I just kept getting faster and faster, and finally I said, okay, I've just fielded a ground ball, and I'm going to throw it home like it's a 1-2-3 double play. And that's where the quick windup came about, you know. And I was my record early in 74 was 4-6, and we came off a road trip. We were at O'Hare Airport getting our luggage, and Chuck said, "Come in and see me a little early tomorrow, Chuck Tanner." Well, my first thought was that you know, because Harry Carey was calling for my scalp, he couldn't understand why they kept running me out there. And
you were just one of many. You were one of many.
Right. So Harry's great line was, if your fastball and your slow curve are the same speed, it's time to call it a career. So I go in and see Chuck, and the first thing he says, he slaps me on the shoulder. You know, he's one of the most positive guys you'll ever be around. And he said, look, you've been
averaging
15 wins a year for 15 years. I think you can still do it. You're going to start a week from Monday against Cleveland. Go down the bullpen every day with Johnny and see what you can figure out. And that's where that quick pitch came from. And I ended up that year 21-13. And without, I would say, just about any other manager I played for other than Chuck Tanner would have probably advised the front office to release me. But Chuck was, he loved his veterans, and he was, he believed in me. And, you know, I owe him so much, like I do Jack McKeon, who was that kind of manager for me in the minor leagues, playing manager.
Trader Jack.
Oh, yeah. He was 27, and I was 19. And now Jack is 93, still living in North Carolina, doing some scouting. But he had a great influence on my career in 1958.
Yeah, he's in Burlington, North Carolina, and my son lives there as well, and he goes to the gym with him every morning. He's a big guy for working out. But let's get to Roger Hendler. He's in Atlanta right now, and moved out of Philadelphia, moved to Atlanta. You're on with Jim Cobb, Roger.
Oh, I know. What an honor. Jim, you know, I'm looking at the statistics in your career, and it just reminds me of that great period when you were with the Phillies. 76-79, Steve Carlton, Mike Schmidt, Greg Luzinski. We thought that maybe get to the World Series during that period. That had to be exciting. But one of the things that really, and Don and I talk about this all the time, and it's just the going deep into games anymore. It doesn't happen. And they just had a statistic out today, which I would challenge. It was about the war, you know, with pitchers. And they said that this, now that the team of Nolan Wheeler has the best war of any tandem, and Steve Carlton never had anybody to work with. And I'm thinking when I read this, wait a minute, Jim Cott was there during the peak period of the Phillies with Steve Carlton. What about that twosome? But, you know, it wasn't brought up. And here you're a Hall of Famer. I don't get it.
Well, of course, Jim Lonborg was a big part of our pitching rotation. And the Phillies didn't get the best of me. You know, I was an every three-day, every four-day pitcher. And Danny, he kind of liked to spot start guys. You know, Danny Ozark, nice guy. But I really think if Whitey Herzog had been managing those teams, Whitey was just so sharp in maneuvering his bullpen, because those were physical ability. Those were the best teams that I was ever on. Those teams in the late '60s with the guys that you mentioned. But you mentioned WAR, and I speak out about this all the time. WAR is one of the phoniest, deceiving stats that there is, because there's so many ways you can shoot holes in it. We could do a whole program by it. I think there's even general managers that don't, first of all, they don't understand all of it, and they don't really abide by it, you know. But the people that are behind the scenes that have never played and don't know the game, they have a little acronym that they can latch onto and make it sound like they're smart, and that's WAR.
Well, yeah, I think that's really interesting, because now Aaron Boone's, you know, they completely redid, Cashman and Boone redid their team of experts, supposedly, because they weren't effective last year and they couldn't transmit the information to the players and the managers and so forth. And now they got a guy from MIT that's going to sit on the bench next to Boone and give them all this information.
Yeah.
I just don't understand how, I mean, these guys have played baseball all their lives. And a guy sitting in it from MIT is going to tell you what to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, if they I do a podcast tomorrow, and we're going to talk about that. But I say, if you took all the money that they invested in analytics departments, and I mean, teams are pouring millions into it,
right?
And you just hired some former players that had big league experience. And paid them big money. Right now, if you said to Greg Maddux, we'll pay you $10 million a year. You come out of Las Vegas and you coach our pitchers. Well, I'll guarantee you those pitchers would learn a lot about pitching from Greg Maddux. But, you know, they don't pay coaches a lot of money, and they're putting all their faith now in the science instead of – there's an article the other day that said basically those of us that have previous experience, we really don't have a place in the game. And I can tell you that the things I learned from Warren Spahn and Whitey Ford and Robin Roberts, guys who were all Hall of Famers, and picking their brain, I mean, without them, I don't know what my career would have been like. But those are the guys I wanted to lean on, guys that had done it and were successful doing it.
Roger?
Well, I was thinking about Harvey Haddix and the 13 perfect game. And, nobody today, they're lucky if they can do that. Six innings, you know, and bring on the bullpen. And it just amazes me. I'm so used to growing up with you and the Robin Roberts, Kurt Simmons, the pitchers when I was a kid. And not necessarily a kid, but in my school years, and it just annoys me to see the way the pitching staffs are ruined or not really handled properly, I guess is the right term today.
Well, they're all hung up on this third time through the batting order, and it's really not
the
pitcher's fault; it's the system. And even Max Scherzer spoke out the other day, and this goes back to what the commissioner had told us at our Hall of Fame meeting last summer. He said, what we really miss is the marquee starting pitcher matchup. Like, I remember doing a game in Philly 10, 12 years ago, and it was Pedro Martinez against Tim Lincecum, and they both went, I think Pedro might have gone the distance. Maybe Brad Lidge saved it, but, I mean, the starters were there almost to the end. But now even Scherzer says he wishes that, you know, they would allow us to go deeper in the game. But they have the geniuses that think that third time through the batting order that, you know, the numbers say you can't let them do that. I said to Sandy Koufax, because he beat us in Game 7, 1965, and we had a couple men on in the fifth inning. We were starting to make some noise. I said, man, if analytics were around then, they might have taken him out in the fifth inning. what a bonus.
Well, that was quite a series, because you guys won the first two games, and then it went seven, and you finally lost in the seventh game.
We ran into, you know, Koufax and Drysdale. They just didn't give us we didn't score much off them after that.
I loved your comment when you said you warmed up right next to Koufax before the game, and you were listening to the ball banging into the catcher's glove.
Yeah.
And you said, I don't think everybody's ever going to hit this guy.
yeah, he was something special.
Well, I'll tell you, let's go to one other thing, because the Phillies had, and Roger, I think, would allude to it as well. Timmy, my great friend Timmy, lived right pretty close to us here in Sarasota, and he was on the show quite often. And Steve Carlton and Timmy just had that great rapport. Was there any catcher, Jim, that you really had a great rapport with outside of the pitching coaches that you worked with and then the talented managers that you worked with? Was there a catcher that you really said, man, this guy knows what I want to do?
Well, I think I was fortunate. I said in my Hall of Fame speech, I had 38 different catchers. Actually, Timmy was one of them. Timmy caught me a couple times in spring training, but never much during the season. But he was such a bright catcher. And I had Earl Batty early in my career, and Earl was this laid-back, mellow, easygoing guy. And for me as a young pitcher, that was really important. You know, he kept my emotions, helped me keep my emotions under control. And then later as a veteran, I ended up pitching a lot to Phil Roof, who was still in the Twins organization as kind of a catching advisor. But Phil was one of those guys that we just kind of clicked when you look down and you're thinking, I think it's a good time for a fastball, and you see number one or vice versa, and you're on the same page. That's really what the chemistry is between pitcher and catcher, and Phil was one of those that was very good for me.
Roger?
Yeah, I know. Roy Halladay said that Carlos Ruiz was the best catcher he ever worked with. And, unfortunately, it wasn't for as long a period as everyone had hoped. But, and obviously he was, when they won the World Series in 08 and they had success in 09 losing to the Yankees. But I wanted to ask you, going back to the Twins, I remember that 65 World Series, and it was interesting. I was doing a show up in Princeton a number of years ago, and we had Don Drysdale on, and he was alluding to that series and the Twins. And I found it very, very interesting coming from the Dodgers' perspective, and now getting to talk to you and your perspective about it. But, that was just a wonderful time of baseball, a wonderful period, and just great teams. But, you were such a great fielding pitcher, Jim. And, everybody knew that. And now, at least pitchers don't have to worry about that anymore. How do you feel about that? Because, you've been a great broadcaster, so you can express your opinion about anything.
Well, I'm very outspoken about it. I know the commissioner said to me, a lot of the front office people used to be Park Avenue, the office is on 6th Avenue now, but they don't like the analytics any more than most of us that are, kind of like the traditions that the game had, bunt, hit and run, steal, things like that. But he said organizations claim that, this analytics stuff helps them win two or three more games a year. And I'm thinking, well, how stupid is that? Because if they all have the same information. So if this team wins, there's another team that's losing.
Right.
And then I said, I said, the next time a general manager says that analytics are helping them win an extra three games a year, you tell them that by not teaching their pitchers how to field their position, it's costing them about six games a year because they're never in position to field the ball. They're getting hit in the back. They're getting hit all over the place. And they don't even in spring training stress the fundamentals like we did. I mean, we did those things over and over, and it would get a little boring after a while, but it paid off because that's where you build your foundation for being able to execute the fundamentals, and teams don't put that kind of time into it anymore.
Jimmy, before we run out of time, just a couple of things about your broadcasting career. First of all, you retired and became a pitching coach, and then you were with the Yankees at the end and wound up in the booth. Was Bobby Mercer with you in the booth up there? Where he hadn't passed away at that time, but was he with you in the
Bobby
booth? I can't remember.
Bobby and I, we worked quite a few games together.
That was the
biggest break I got, really. Tony Kubek, who had retired, and I knew Tony when I was doing Twins games, and he did some Toronto games years ago and then Yankee games, and he was always very complimentary to me. And so when he decided to retire, He suggested to the Madison Square Garden Network that they hire me. So that's really led me into getting the Yankee job, which I did for 13 years. And what a great 13 years it was, because that's when, you know, Derek came up in 95. And they had good teams right through, I think they won again in like 2008 or so, and then things went the other way. But, boy, those were great teams to follow, those Yankees in the late 90s.
I've never met anybody that retired from as many things as you have. I listened to you when you were retiring from baseball. Well, I'm going to take up a radio career now. 13 years later, you sat in the booth, I can remember, and they were so complimentary to you and always talked about, why is this man not in the Hall of Fame? But 13 years later, I'm going to retire and play golf, going to go to Huizinga's place down there and hit some golf balls every day. Next thing you know, you and Bob Costas are on MLB. I said, this guy's retired from more places than the President of the United States.
Well, I never really retired. They always ask me when I retire. I never retired as a player. They just decided to let me go. And then just with the announcing, I actually walked away from the Yankee job in 2007 because my late wife was battling cancer and subsequently passed away in 2008. And then the MLB Network launched in 2009.
Right.
And Tony Petitti called me and said, would you like to do some games again? And I didn't want to do a lot of games, but it worked out. So Bob and I, for 14 years, did like 10 to 15 games a year, which was really enjoyable.
Roger?
Do you see yourself getting back and doing some games on TV, on MLB or, Yankees, Phillies, or any? I'll tell you, last year, the Braves had former players – and all former players, Jeff Francoeur, Smoltz, Glavin and Chipper. Okay.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned Greg Maddux, but he's in Vegas, like you said. It was fascinating. I mean, they didn't have anybody, just the four of them. And, and Glavin is definitely serious. He was not cracking many smiles because he's really into the game, and Chipper was having a ball, but they all did. It was fascinating, and I would love to see that with more of just you and players just talking about the game, and especially like with yourself with all the broadcast experience you've had.
Well, the best 6 years, and I liked all the guys I worked with. I worked with, good training from Dick Enberg and Dick Stockton, a little bit from John Madden. But when Kenny Singleton and I did Yankee games, just two former players, and we could switch off the play-by-play, it was just two guys talking baseball. And those were the best years. But really what caused me to leave the booth a couple years ago is that it's become so data-driven. They got all the numbers on TV, and you hardly have any time to really talk about what's going on in the field because they have all these percentages, and then they're all sponsored. The StatCast might be one of the worst things to come into the game. It's altered so many the way players play and the way teams operate. And I just said, I don't want to use the booth as a platform to talk about how stupid I think some of the things are that they're doing, because that's not your job in the booth. You want to make it enjoyable for people. And I said, I can't do that anymore because the game is not enjoyable to me anymore. So I just walked away.
Well, that's almost parallel to what the last time I talked to Bill White, which was maybe 2 months ago, month and a half ago or so. And he said that exactly what you're saying. I can't watch baseball anymore.
No, he doesn't watch anymore either, I know. Well, that's true. And, I'm glad there are fans that like the game the way it is today. That's fine if they like power and the strikeouts. But, that's not the game that I fell in love with as a kid and that I like to follow. So I'm not going to change the game, but I don't have to be a part of it. I still follow it. I still do a little ambassador work for the Twins, and I don't have anything to do with the baseball ops because like the modern people said, those of you with previous experience really have no voice anymore because we have artificial information that is a lot better than what you guys can offer, so we stay out of the way.
Well, that was really interesting. We had Larry Bowe on with us 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I said to Larry, you know, if you're managing today and you got your pitching staff all lined up, and how would you go about it? He said, I can't. They wouldn't let me.
So right. He said, yeah.
He said, there's no sense even talking about it because it's past history. They have somebody there that's going to tell you what to do every minute, and you're not really running the club. Although I won't say
right.
that. I won't say that for the manager of the Texas Rangers. He runs this club, and he analytics is not a top-shelf item with him.
Right. Yeah.
Which is refreshing. I mean, that Bruce Bochy has taken that position. The other thing that annoys Don Frank and me is all these gambling statistics. And like you said, Jim, sponsored. Okay? Oh, yeah. Tonight's over-under sponsored by such and such. It never ends.
Yeah.
And I'll just turn the sound down and won't even listen to it. And I do the same thing with the NFL. I'll watch it. I could care less about the broadcasting when they're doing it this way. I want to do it like you said that you when you grew up with it, and we're traditionalists. That's baseball, and that's the way I want to watch it.
Jimmy,
yeah,
before
we
run out of time, you also made the transition. Of course, you had gone to college and worked a little bit on journalism, but you wrote a marvelous book, and I want to give you a chance. Of course, it's a year or so old now, but give you a chance to talk a little bit about it because there are a lot of people that still would like to get it and have a chance to read it and get some of the information from you through the book knowledge as well. The name and where can people get it today?
Yeah, I think it's out of publication now. I mean, they could get it like on Amazon or eBay, but it's really about my 8 decades in baseball. I broke down, I didn't play for 80 years, but my career touched starting in the 50s and then right into 2022. Bob Costas was adamant about it. He wanted me to work into the 2020s with him because he said then your career would cover 8 decades. I think maybe Vin Scully and maybe Uke now. I don't think Uke started till the 60s, but so it's a little bit about, you know, what went on in each decade and then how the game has changed and the things I like about it and the things I don't like about it. You know, I mean, most of the things I don't like, what I like is that the players today are the most talented group of players that I've seen. They're so athletic and talented, and I just wish that they would just let them play instead of making robots out of them.
Roger.
Because we would see a top quality of baseball.
Jim, we talked about this many times on the show, and I go to a lot of high school games in the area that I live, and I'm friends with the parents of a number of players, so it's like become a real family. But the one thing that we always talk about is the arms of pitchers wearing out. Because when they're young, yes, they're limited on what they can do in Little League. They're limited what they can do in Babe Ruth. And they're limited in high school. But the problem is when they are playing in two leagues, there's not that much control. And I really think we think that that has definitely had an effect on all these pitchers having to get Tommy John surgery before they're 22 years old.
Oh, there's no question. I have a good friend who's a physical therapist in New Jersey, and he's got right now double-digit teenagers who have had the Tommy John surgery or are rehabbing. But you know, the problem is they think that pitch counts and inning restrictions will solve the problem. That's not it. They have to somewhere along the line. MLB has to invest a lot of money into getting coaches to teach kids how to throw properly and kind of put a governor on them. For example, Lucas Giolito, if you followed that story, now looks like he may have season-ending surgery. And the Red Sox had him all built up. He was going to be their innings eater because they thought he could get 180 innings out of him. Well, Lucas Giolito was first clocked at 90 miles an hour when he was 14. And then he had Tommy John surgery when he was 18. I mean, that's another accident waiting to happen. So we got to do something with our youth to be able to, you know, to not throw 90 miles an hour if you're capable. Let's just pitch at about 80 and don't worry about the number of pitches. Let's worry about the number of strikes and the number of outs and get back to, you know, the way the game should be played. And that's where it has to start, or we're going to continue to have those injuries. And Dr. Andrews, who's retired now, but he said the same thing, this travel ball and all these leagues.
Jim, we only have 1 minute to go,
okay.
I think you had a little bit of an advantage because you were so small in high school.
Right.
Well, you were.
That's right.
You got big, you know, when you were first year in college and so forth. So you didn't throw that hard. How hard did you throw when you first came up?
We had no idea. We didn't count pitches and we didn't clock pitches. We just counted outs.
That's the way
Jim,
it should
be. Hall of Famer Jim, I want to thank you so very, very much for being on with us tonight. I hope we do it again. You're a little bit more in-depth with your book and some of the other things that you think are positive and negative about baseball as we look at it today. And once again, my thanks to Billy Wernendael and to Bill White. Bill White's 3 months older than I am, so
yeah.
I don't get to the 90 mark until June the 18th, so he's way ahead of me.
Well, you're doing well. That's good.
Jim,
thank you so much
for
it.
Okay.
We'll get together again soon.
All right, guys.
Take care.
Thanks, take care.
All right, we're going to switch over now to football as we always do. Trevor's ready to go. Trevor Bosco, and talk about what's happening in the USFL, what's happening with football as it comes back around again. So, Trevor, let's get started for this week. What do we got on the top burner?
Thank you guys for having me on. I appreciate it, as always.
Always
upcoming
a pleasure,
news
Trevor.
To the UFL.
Wait a minute. Something. We got something on the radio in the background or something.
Yeah, we got to take care. Keep going.
Okay, Trevor.
Okay.
Trevor, go ahead.
So on March 8th, we have team scrimmages. March 10th, we have teams cutting down from 75 man on the roster to 57. March 23rd, we have teams cutting down from 57 to 50. And then week one of the season will be March 30th. So the days are counting down for the UFL's upcoming season. We have to stop saying USFL. It is the UFL. It is the new merged entity of spring football. And I do believe it's going to be a juggernaut. The amount of quality competition and overall talent in this league is pretty substantial, and I'm pretty excited.
Roger.
Well, I'll tell you, it's hard to believe we're here, and it's going to be exciting. I agree with you, Trevor. And any surprises on the cuts already of any names that may be more well known than others?
Nothing like that. If you guys want more like in-tune roster and team news and stuff like that, make sure you just check out the podcast. I do about 3 episodes regarding the UFL every week. We also are pretty prevalent on YouTube, Tee Time Reports. Check that out. But nothing massive in terms of any big waivers or anything like that. A couple guys.
How about Vince Papale's son? How's Vince Papale's son doing?
Denny Jr.
The Memphis Showboats are looking good. They probably have the best quarterback room in the league in terms of depth. You could argue the Stallions with Matt Corral, obviously a high round draft pick in the NFL, but in terms of proven spring league starters, I do believe that Vinny Papale Jr. is in a prime spot right now with really good talent at the quarterback position that are going to make him be able to flourish and be able to, you know, showcase his abilities. But he himself has a challenge ahead of him. They have a loaded wide receiver room as well. It's going to be more difficult than ever to make the final 50 on one of these rosters. So definitely something to look out for. But, I have high hopes for him. I have high hopes for the Memphis Showboats, you know, ability as an offensive unit. John DeFilippo, he was the coach for the New Orleans Breakers last year, and they made the playoffs, and he brought his staff and a lot of his players over. And I think they're going to implement a good scheme to get, you know, the slot receivers like Vinny, you know, out in space and, you know, be able to make plays.
Roger?
Well, I had inquired and asked you, and then I did some checking on Teron Vincent, Troy Vincent's son, and he is with San Antonio. And I'm just wondering, because he did make the NFL as a non-draftee last year with, I think, the Rams first and then another team, but then he was cut. And I'm just hoping that he can do well. But let me ask you this, because you really know the league. It's very difficult to get an email or a telephone number for the league or the teams. Am I right about that or not? I've tried because I was going to call San Antonio to try to hook up with him. But everything you see, it really gives you the league, but it does not give you any information other maybe the owner's name or something like that. Am I wrong about that? Because, you know a heck of a lot more about it than I do.
Well, the thing is that I imagine that, trying to contact the teams in general is going to be difficult because there's no actual private ownership of any team yet. They're all just owned by ESPN and Fox. So it's like trying to get a hold of one of those big networks in a sense. It's pretty much impossible unless obviously you have an appointment or a meeting set up or something like that. I'm not too sure about the logistical side of that, but what I do know, on social media.
Well, Trevor, don't they have any PR people with each one of these teams?
Well, that's what I was wondering. Don't they have any PR, like Don said? Where are they?
Basically, I am not aware of how they operate in that manner because I am not behind those doors. But I do imagine that it is pretty difficult to get in touch with those organizations, not only because training camp is kicked off and the season's right around the corner, but we don't have any credentials to speak with them for any manner. You have to check the rosters online or do your due diligence on social media if you're trying to be a fan of this league in that kind of way. But, I'm not aware about how those things work.
Roger?
Well, I just thought that each team, I would think, would have some kind of PR, individual or department, to get the message out to each market. I mean, to get fans to come and get interest in it. And, I mean, Fox does a great job. And I understand that, Trevor. And listen, I'm not saying anything other than I just was asking a question because you know a lot more about the inner workings than I do. I just tried to get some information, and I could not get anything.
Well, Trevor, how do you get your information for not only the rosters but people coming in, going out, the things that are going to be going on with the league, with TV? Where do you go to get all this information?
The UFL.com, as well as James Larson on Twitter, as well as ESPN, Fox. Each team has had its own advertisement and marketing during the NFL playoffs. I mean, they've done a great job marketing. St. Louis, in its season last year, had over 60,000 people in attendance to their games. So the marketing teams have done their job, and it's a matter of, getting these teams and clubs bigger, Getting a first owner is a huge step. Getting, in touch with the communities or that's been prevalent in terms of the USFL, Birmingham, Memphis. They did work at schools and restaurants and team meetings and community meetings and stuff like that. And it's pretty prevalent all over social media.
Roger?
Well, I have to be honest with you. I am not into social media very much. I mean, I'm in Facebook. The only thing I ever read is if somebody sends me something that's new about them, and I'll go on there. I got into it originally because my daughter was in it and had pictures of my granddaughters. She's not in it anymore. Their granddaughters are older. But what the name of the you mentioned of that gentleman? Who is he? I mean, that you get a lot of information. Is he a spokesman for the league?
James Larson is. I don't think he's actually affiliated with the league. Just a guy that's been covering spring football on his own time for a long time, grown a following, and is probably the most reliable source of information outside the league itself, which the league does drop its own transaction lists and players coming in and out and coaching hirings and stuff like that, they make their own statements, and they're released on their social media platforms as well as the website, which I will say the UFL.com website is actually pretty simple and easy to navigate, and you can read all the rosters and team news and stuff on there. I did also have one last thing to discuss about the UFL. They did partner up with a coaching program that is supposedly getting high school coaches involved with the local teams from their respective, you know, areas to get them more experience, to give them those kind of intern and shadowing, you know, membership kind of deal, not paid jobs, but I would say internships, to give them that experience in coaching at a different level, at that semi-pro slash pro level. It's priceless experience and knowledge you can gain from that. And I think that's a pretty cool thing that ESPN and Fox were able to do, because this, I forget what the actual organization was called, but I think it's something along the lines of coaching young coaches experience or something, but they did actually incorporate this organization into the XFL season last year in San Antonio and Seattle, I believe it was. And Seattle's gone, you know, that's not important, but they're doing it for all 8 teams just to get more in touch with the community, get maybe even more, you know, ideas of the youth coming out of these local areas to encourage kids, hey, you know what, if you're getting offers from, you know, AA and AAA schools, you guys can come and look out for UFL teams to look out for you and stuff like that. I just think that opens up a whole different range of recruitment, development, and scouting as well for the league. So I just think that that's pretty important to mention.
Oh, I agree. And that's what I'm looking for. And that's, I think, what Don's looking for, that we want to find out. How do you get to find out and talk to somebody that can tell us all about this? I will tell you that locally, I subbed for the football coach at one of the high schools last week, because they had the, I guess, statewide in Georgia, they had all the high school coaches down at the football hall of the College Football Hall of Fame, where they can handle a huge amount on the field and everything that they have set up there, and they have meeting rooms and everything, and that's where they were. And I agree with you. I think that is a great move. To get involved with youth coaches. And I agree with you also, Trevor, about the website. I did go on that. It is easy to manipulate and get information, but it just does not give you any contact information or phone number that I saw. I mean, you know, it has the website, but, you know, maybe I haven't looked at it in a week or a couple weeks, I guess. So,
well, fellas,
I don't know.
You're getting closer now to the beginning of the season. And to me, I would just think normally you'd have to have a lot more information coming in about rosters and you know, possible trades and all the things that lead up to the last week of training camp and so forth. I'll be very honest with you. I don't see anything in the paper. I don't see anything in the paper that regards to teams. Now, fortunately, you know, or unfortunately, we're down in Florida. There's no team here. But I look at the paper every day, and I get a lot of papers. And I got to be honest with you. Other than you, Trevor, I wouldn't have any information at all, except that, you know, maybe a 55 or 75-man roster. I wouldn't know anything.
No, I understand there might be a definite disconnect in some of the audience, because obviously the NFL has more exposure, resources, and distribution. But in terms of what the UFL is doing, it's kind of sticking to a strictly digital kind of plan.
Right.
To most, it is accessible. It's, you know, doable. But, you know, to those, you know, people out there that aren't really in tune with technology and social media, they're not going to be able to get all the latest information. That's something that they'll probably have to work on and change. But, you know, probably to them, it's not a priority. Just based on what social media and how huge it is now, despite people's thoughts on it, it is one of those things where you can actually get your word out there regardless. And like you said, hopefully you'll hear it from other people if you can't see it yourself, or, you know, you'll be surprised by you know, Roger.
Well, I guess once the season starts, I guess you'll get some information then. Roger, you're up.
Well, I would hope so, and I guess you know when you are they going to play? And I asked this before, and I'm sorry, I'm having a senior moment. Are they going to play in each one of the cities, or is it going to be centralized like it was in the past?
No, each team has their own respective stadium in their own respective city. So traveling
Good.
Will be a thing. There will be home field advantage, and each city will have, you know, their own team to kind of go out and cheer for. And there will be probably an even bigger turnout. I'll say this. They chose some of the better markets. A lot of people will argue, you know, oh, why three teams in Texas? Texas is probably the biggest football state. You can argue Florida, maybe Tennessee, but it's prime location for teams, talent, and scouting, and just bringing guys in and together. But in my personal opinion, if they're able to get this off the right way, this could expand into probably upwards of maybe a 16 to 18 team league. And, you know, maybe the regular season will expand to maybe that 14-week regular season plus the 2 weeks of postseason, not including the championship game. But there's a lot of room for growth, but everything kind of has to go, you know, the right way. And I think with a combination of both of the USFL and the XFL, both leagues doing good things in their own respective ways, one with, you know, in-house attendance, and the USFL with their marketing and business plan as a whole, I think that we got the right minds on this. And, you know, we're going to see week one when both former championship teams kick off at 1 p.m. in Arlington, Texas. It's going to be a very fun product to watch. And
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, there are so many football players, you know, and when you think about the National Football League and the 30 teams and cutting down, trying to get the rosters down, there are so many players that are still very, very pro qualified who have gone through college or haven't gone through college. And there's a lot of room for players to improve and even increase and get to the National Football League if they need a year, 2 years of experience before they can make it into the National Football League. I agree with you. I think it's a great opportunity. I think it could expand. And what's the roster size going to be, 55?
So the final roster size is going to be 50. Every team going into training camp has 75 guys right now. And you can be over, I think, by one, but you have to make that correction within 24
right.
hours or you are penalized.
Yeah, well, only time will tell. I mean, I'm a fan. I was a fan, and I think that so many times we go back to what the USFL was when it started. And Don and I and your grandfather are well aware that they had a great PR staff. It was just a level less than the NFL, obviously. But you're also talking about many years ago now. And I think that we have to adjust our thinking to the way it is today, Trevor, as you said, with social media. It's different. It's a different world. That's all I can say, in many ways.
It really is, and it can definitely be a negative or a positive thing, but in terms of football, I think we all can agree that we want American football to be the biggest sport in the world, and this is one of those biggest, like one of the bigger steps to get it there and grow more fan bases and get more teams and clubs and positions and job openings for people that want to be a part of this great game. And you know, it's going to be definitely a very fun experience. I'm glad to be able to come on the show and talk about it with you guys and, you know, spread the word in a sense, you know, because I think it's important to get a lot of these players and coaches and hell, even the rest, you know, an opportunity to get up to the next level, make some money for themselves and play on that high stage and, you know, compete at the next level.
Not only that, but look at the streaming possibilities. Now, I see where Fox just signed another big contract yesterday that they may even start streaming this year. And holy smokes, every other channel is going to be involved as well. As you mentioned, on previous shows, there was only one network that really did not do a first-class job last year. But for the most part, every time they're on ESPN or things of that nature, they get pretty good results. And as you said, there was only one network that was a little bit behind the times.
No, I think it's a perfect merger in all senses of the word. It's just got to come to fruition. Like you guys said, only time will tell. Fox and ESPN, USFL and XFL, all four entities, you know, genuinely good things, have done good things, have had history, are able to get numbers and get that reach and exposure. You know, with all these things combined, I think that, you know, we're in for something special. And, you know, maybe that next big league in a sense, and hopefully for years to come.
Roger.
Well, listen, Trevor, we appreciate it. You know, as always, every week, and as we get closer to the opening of the season, it'll really get exciting. And we all know it's all about money. They all want to make money, every one of these enterprises. And I just read the other day about what they expect high school sports to generate in the next few years. And that's why a lot of investors, a lot of people, a lot of individuals are getting involved. So listen, Trevor, have a great week, and we'll see. And I'll keep on working at it to try to get somebody contact, okay? I'm not going to burden you, buddy, okay?
No, if anything, try go on and try and make a little Twitter account and, you know, follow some of the accounts. Even on Facebook, they have a UFL Facebook account. Anyone out there can go and see the training camp videos and stuff like that. It's not all, you know, terrible social media content. It's actually good football stuff. They do a good job. But like you said, it is strange that there is no contact information to get, you know, immediately in touch with someone. But it's somewhat to be expected with, you know, a smaller league that's just now kind of making its headway into the next phase. But I do
Trevor,
hope they change
Trevor,
that.
Roger and I are in the dark ages.
Hey,
you're going to be our guiding light to the league and the players and the team.
Well, I don't mind doing that at all. I appreciate you guys, and have a great rest of your night and week, okay?
Okay, take care, Trevor. We'll talk to you next week.
Take care.
Okay, we're going to switch over to high school sports now, okay, of which I love. Yeah, and Don and Frank know this. And it's a real pleasure to have Brad Cutlass on, who's the head basketball coach for the girls at North Forsyth High School. They are at 31-0 in 6A in Georgia. They're ranked number 3, and they're going to be playing on Friday at night in Macon at the Convention Center against number 2 ranked Marist at 29-1. I'll tell you this, Brad, I don't get how River Ridge at 26-5 is ranked number 1. I mean, Marist is 2 and you're 3. Okay, that makes no sense, except I don't understand ratings many times. So welcome to the show. It's going to be an exciting time, and you've had a great season. You've got some great players. They're the best high school girls team I've ever seen. I'm very adamant about that.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. That's a lot. I appreciate it. The girls work hard. They play hard. With those rankings, you're probably looking at the max prep ones. That takes
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah, they calculate in your strength of schedule and things like that. And, you know, River Ridge had a tough strength of schedule. They went out and played some top teams inside and outside of Georgia, and they had a tougher region than we did. And so that kind of comes into play on that. You know, you can't control your region schedule. You just play who you can play, and you try to win the games, and that's, you know, the girls have been doing a good job of that all season, so hopefully we can do it one more game.
Brad, the one thing that Roger's been talking to me about is that what a trip you had to make to play in the semifinals. I mean, it wasn't like you were playing right around the corner.
No, we had to go down to West Georgia. I mean, there could have been, you know, some of these teams had to travel down to South Georgia, so luckily we didn't have to go down there, but Yeah, we had a good turnout. Our Coal Mountain crowd, Forsyth County, just we travel very well. They love their girls' basketball there. They love their basketball, I mean, and especially girls. And we've been trying to put together a really good product and show it off and really just encourage girls' basketball. And, you know, we run fast and shoot a bunch of threes and layups and just get after it. The thing I love about my girls is that they play for each other. There's no one that, you know, has to have the ball every time. It's if London's hot or if Gabby's hot, we're going to run hand that night, and they're going to cheer each other on the whole way.
Yeah, well, they're a team, and the one thing I noticed is your defense is stifling. I mean, when you really implement that, it takes over. I wanted to talk about a couple of the players. I mean, Lindsay Perkle, a senior at 6'2". I understand, is she going to Union College?
Yes, sir. Yes, she's going to be at Union College next year. She's come on big. I mean, she's a couple of rebounds from breaking the school record for rebounds in a season. She's already got the ones in the game at 18 earlier this year, tied the school record for blocks. I mean, having her inside has been tremendous for us because, you know, we like to put a lot of ball pressure on the other team, and you're going to get beat at times, and it's nice to know that Lindsay's got your back there. And then we got, you know, Abby and that comes off the bench, and she's just a springboard. I mean, she's all over the place. And then Sophia, who, you know, she's our lockdown defender. And, you know, she's got a big task ahead of her on Friday, and you know, she's been working hard all week to embrace that role and to take on that challenge.
Roger, we'll let you close this segment out with Brad. Mike Simzek is ready to go, so you can close this one out.
Okay, I just wanted to say that another player that's just tremendous, London Weaver, a junior at 6 feet, because once she started hitting threes in that game against Woodford, that's what turned it around, in my opinion.
Yeah, she dropped down 5 threes in that game. I think she 5 threes, 5 2-pointers, and five free throws. It was like the nine to five. But she's a sharpshooter, you know. She had a game earlier this year where she hit 7 threes in the first quarter, you know. And
wow.
You know what I love about London, though, is she's so unselfish. She had 7 threes in that first quarter. I think we were playing Jackson County. And, you know, I'm like, hey, man, you got to get that school record. And you know, other teammates were open, and she made the right basketball read. So and she ended
maybe
up
maybe she's got to go to Iowa.
yeah, right.
So
the replacement for Caitlin Clark. But listen, Brad, we're gonna be there. You're right. You're getting tremendous support, and all you got to do is look at the on front line and see all the openings for subs that are needed on Friday. Because you know where everybody's going. I can tell you that. They're heading south to Macon. So I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be exciting. I'm looking for a great game. I know what Marist is like. I know their history. I've seen them in the past. And But listen, I'm with you, and you've just done a great job. Congratulations, and you just have a wonderful team.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. You know, thanks for letting us come on and represent, you know, Coal Mountain, North Forsyth, and, you know, the first time in school history that we've been able to go to make it to the finals, and hopefully we can finish it off. That's what our goal is.
We're with
well,
you.
Well, best
absolutely.
Of luck, Brad. We certainly all will root for you. We hope you get there, not only get there, but win. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You guys have a wonderful night.
You too,
Mike
Brad.
Mike Simzek is
care.
Ready to go, as always, this time as we follow through. And, Mike, a lot of news down there in Washington, a lot of news in Baltimore. Things are going in the soccer front. MLS is underway as well with the season. So which way would you like to start? Are you going to start with soccer, football, baseball? What would you like to touch on?
We can start with Roger and Brown. We can go whatever direction you guys want to go.
Hey, listen,
well, let's start.
It's your call, brother.
let's start with football. Then. Because we're getting close to, decisions about who's going to be let go and not signed in the contract. Who do you have down there in Washington, do you think, and Baltimore? Don't just have to talk about Washington. Baltimore as well. Any players that you're looking at that are on the fringe or going to be released because of salary cap?
Well, I don't think that we're going to see many surprise releases. I know the Commanders just released Logan Thomas. They're kind of injury-prone veteran tight end.
Right.
The Ravens made the decision to put the franchise tag on their defensive tackle, Justin Madubuike. Both teams have some salary cap space, but they also both have a lot of free agents. The Redskins had, on a 53-man roster, they had 30 free agents. So, yeah, they've got $90 million in cap space, $80 million in cap space now. But I know for the Commanders, they've got to replace pretty much half of their 53-man roster. Cam Curl is an interesting one to watch here in Washington, the safety. Their defense the last couple of years has been markedly better when he's on, and all the metrics show that he's a pretty solid safety. There's just one problem. He doesn't get interceptions. Going into his fifth year. He has had one interception his rookie year in his career, and that's it. So if he wants he's going to look for top of the market money, that Minka Fitzpatrick type money, and it's going to be really interesting to see if he gets it. I don't think the market's there, so it'll be interesting to see. The Commanders could really use him.
The biggest cap space, right? We were talking with Billy Wardell last week about it, and he was saying that they could almost rebuild the team with the space they have between where they are now and the cap.
Yeah, they could rebuild the team, and they're going to have to because they have so many roster openings.
Right.
And they can afford to spend, but they can't afford to spend stupidly because, yeah, they have a lot of positions open, but they're going to have to come up with a solution to Jonathan Allen's contract. Do you extend him? Do you restructure him? What do you do with him? They're going to have to find, like I said, Cam Curl. They're going to have to eventually make a decision on Jahan Dotson in a year or two. So there are things. Plus, they have so many free agents this year, like I said, that, yeah, they're rebuilding the team, and you can't go out and spend top-of-the-market money on everybody. You're going to have to get some guys on affordable contracts in there.
Right.
They did make one signing today. Zach Ertz, the 35-year-old, coming in as a tight end. A bit of an interesting move. They got rid of Logan Thomas, who was an injury-prone veteran tight end, and signed an injury-prone veteran tight end, who's probably prime days are behind him, and Zach Ertz. I think this has to do more with Ertz's familiarity with Cliff Kingsbury's system more so than anything else. He can't be their number one option as a tight end at this point in his career.
Roger, you're up.
You know what else I think it is, Mike? I think it's also that he's closer to Philadelphia and South Jersey, you know, because of his wife, you know, with the soccer. And I think he still resides in South Jersey. Matter of fact, I thought the Eagles last year when Goddard went out, that there was some speculation that they were going to get Ertz, you know, to come in. This is before they had the fall from, stature, okay, games. But anyway, I think, hey, listen, I'm a big Zach Ertz fan. My question about the Commanders is Dan Quinn getting a welcome by the media in D.C., number one? And number two is, could this be a total rebuild? And then what would the fans, how would that be, what reaction would that be by the fans?
Okay, I'll take the second one first. We already know it's a total rebuild because it's been a rebuilding two decades. This is a
yes.
team that has been rebuilding pretty much since Dan Snyder took over in 2000. So, you know, you're going on to a quarter of a century of continual rebuild. Everybody expects this to be some sort of rebuild. They know that that's what's coming, and they know that's what's necessary. The expectation is very much that there will be a rookie quarterback under center next year. The line needs to be rebuilt. The linebackers need to be rebuilt. You need two rush ends at least. So the defense needs to be rebuilt. This is kind of everybody's – I think the question is remains how much leeway does Josh Harris have? Right now he's a lot of goodwill, but, you know, basically anybody who wasn't Dan Snyder would have a lot of goodwill. How long will that go on for? I would say that the reaction to Dan Quinn was a bit tepid at first, but, you know, the media has been pretty good to him. You know, looking at the record that he had in Dallas, how good the Dallas defense was with him in charge. Plus, you know, Dan Quinn has a couple of playoff wins and a Super Bowl appearance. We can remember that, yes, he did give up that big lead to Tom Brady when he was with the Falcons, but he's been to a Super Bowl. That's something that the Commanders haven't been to in 30 years. You know, they have, what, three playoff appearances and a playoff win in the last 23 years. So I remember when Andy Reid got hired by the Kansas City Chiefs, and they looked at the Philly fans and said, yeah, y'all are complaining about a guy who had the five conference championship games. We had three wins the year before. He's going to be an improvement. So right now, I think that's kind of the idea is, you know, no matter what, he's going to be an improvement over what has been here. So people are willing to give him time.
Well, you're of the opinion that it's going to be a rookie that's going to take over a quarterback and lead this team as opposed to a player that they may pick up, you know, during the free agent period as opposed to just the draft. They're going to put it on the shoulders of a young quarterback to lead this team all the way. You think that's the way it's going to go?
I would find it very hard. I find it very hard to see a scenario in which they don't draft a rookie quarterback high in the first round. Now, if you get somebody like a Jacoby Brissett or, you know, a more veteran quarterback to come in and start a couple of games at the beginning of the season, a la what Doug Peterson did for the Eagles in front of Donovan McNabb, would that surprise me? No, but I know that they're going to draft a quarterback high. I would be very surprised if they don't draft the quarterback with the second pick. I think that somebody would have to come in with an absolutely overwhelming offer for that pick to get them to trade back.
Right.
And even then, I think that they would have in mind somebody who they like. Coming out of the combine, you have Caleb Williams, Drake May, Jaden Daniels, and everybody's now talking about J.J. McCarthy. Those are four quarterbacks who potentially could go in the top 10. They could all be the first four picks. I have a hard time believing that there is not one of that quartet that the Commanders wouldn't like. And so I can't see them going back to Russell Wilson. I can't see them going to Russell Wilson. I can't see them going back to Kirk Cousins. I think it's ultimately going to be a rookie. You may see a stopgap bridge starter for a couple of games, but ultimately this is going to be about developing a young quarterback. And I don't think that that young quarterback is Sam Howell either.
Roger?
Well, no, I know Don has, well, because of North Carolina, it's always been a real strong supporter of Hal. I'll tell you, I don't know whether it would be the Commanders, but I really hope that Mac Jones gets let go by the Patriots and somebody grabs him and has a good quarterback coach that would work with him, because I think Mac Jones can be saved. I think it was a disaster, the whole operation in New England. And, you know, it was during his first couple of years. It was a disgrace. And I always liked him when he was at Alabama. I saw him quite a bit. And I think that he's going to be an asset. Now, you know, maybe it would be somebody like him if, that they would develop, and if they saw the potential, and they probably get it for a pretty good price, because I think this would be, what, his fourth year, I think, Mike, you know, 4 out of 5, and then, of course, you got the fifth year for the rookie. I think this is his fourth year coming up. But I don't know.
Yeah,
but
rookie fifth year
option
quarterbacks is pretty expensive. And so if I'm taking a flyer on Mac Jones, you know, he's not coming in. He might be a cheaper option than somebody else, but and you might be able to get him for next to nothing, especially if he's – well, if he's cut, then there is no more fifth-year option. But there's a lot of issues with Mac Jones. I can't – I'm with you. I can see him going someplace and hopefully sitting behind a more established quarterback and then learning a la kind of what Mitch Trubisky did when he went up to Buffalo and sat behind Josh Allen and suddenly, you know, had a shot to revive his career. And he's a first-round draft pick, so he will get another shot. I know I'd be very surprised if it's down here with the Commanders. I'd be even more surprised if it's up the road a bit with the Baltimore Ravens, whose quarterback situation is basically solidified. There's nothing that they're looking for up there.
Yeah, it's settled. Yeah, it's settled.
Yeah. Well, in the case of Jones, I think you're right. I don't think they'd want to go to somebody who has not been successful. I think they'd maybe in a backup role, but I don't think they'd want to go to him as the quarterback to lead the Commanders out of the darkness. Let's get to the MLS for a second. Anything you want to talk about that?
Well, a few things. Number one, the Union, at least they're consistent. Another draw last night in CONCACAF Champions Cup play, 0-0
right,
at home to Pachuca. That's really a tough it's a tough draw in terms of teams that they have to play. Pachuca are the defending half-season champions down in Mexico. They're second in the league right now. The Union have played – that was their fifth game of the season. Pachuca has played 27. So they're in mid-table form. They're playing really, really well. That the Union were able to hold them at home, I give them a lot of credit. But I'm going to venture to guess that they would lose next week when they go back down to Mexico. Were the Union to win this home and away tie against Pachuca, I would argue that it would have been their biggest win maybe in franchise history. I mean, that would be a big one to defeat this team, especially going down to Mexico to do it. Roger, the local team, the Atlanta United, made a really interesting signing. Yeah, they made an interesting signing. They picked up an Israeli winger for about $10 million. I'm getting figures of between 8 and 10 million pounds, so I'm going to lean to about $10 million. Lyle Abada is a 23-year-old old young player. Have been playing pretty consistently with Celtic and playing at a high level. Two previous years, he was a pretty nailed-on starter, and he was good for about 10 goals plus a season. There was a falling out between him and the fans over he's Israeli. There was some pro-Palestinian support amongst the Celtic supporters who kind of, you know, this is a club that's born out of the Irish potato famine in Glasgow and stuff like that. So they kind of ally themselves to those sorts of political causes. So there was a lot of pro-Palestinian. There was just that relationship between the team and the fans and broke down, so he left. And, yeah, I think they paid a lot of money for him, but this could be a pretty good pickup
Atlanta United is, or I'm sorry, that's not Atlanta United. That's Charlotte FC where he goes. Atlanta, mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Hold it right. Roger, last question before we go to Doug. Go ahead.
Well, no, we'll just follow up on that. Go ahead. Talk about the United and their move. Go ahead.
Well, they're still finalizing their roster. It's a new team. I'm still surprised that they're turning the reins over to Brad, who's on, but they're still looking to get that together. I messed that up. It was Charlotte who picked up Lyle. But we'll get, Atlanta getting off to the start, a fair start, but they need to start picking up the wins and getting that team together.
Getting it straightened out. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Don?
Once again, thank you very much, Mike. Always a pleasure. We'll get together again next week, and I like your observations on Commanders. We'll see what happens there when as we go into this free agent period and, of course, going into the draft. Thank you so much.
Have
always
a great week, Mike.
Talk to you later. Bye.
You too.
Doug, our PGA professional, and the one thing he doesn't have to worry about is a quarterback at Baltimore because he follows the Ravens very, very closely as well as the Baltimore Orioles, and the Orioles are doing a pretty good job in spring training, so they're still looking at that 101 wins of last year. Doug, what do you think?
Yeah, I think they beat the Pirates here this evening, 6-4, I think it was. I think they're 10-2, I think, so far. I mean, if that were to mean anything, but I think they're getting an opportunity for some of these younger guys to play. I think that Jackson Holliday's looked pretty good so far. He's hitting the ball pretty well. I think Colton Cowser's played well. Kobe Mayo's played well. Gunnar Henderson had 3 hits tonight coming back from his injury. So I'm not concerned about the offense so much as the construction of the team. I think there's still some spots up for grabs potentially, depending on whether it's injuries or whether they want to give some of these young guys an opportunity. Starting pitching, I think is still a question mark with 2/5 of your rotation starting the season probably on the injured list. I will say Tyler Wells was really good the first half of last year. I think he's more than an adequate fill-in in their rotation. I think Cole Irvin has looked pretty good this spring. I think he's thrown five shutout innings. He's increased his velocity. He's lost some weight. He's come up with a couple different pitches. I think he was working with Corbin Burns on his grips and learning how to throw a cutter. I think the major concern for me is the back end of the bullpen. Craig Kimbrell's given up, 5 runs in 2 innings or whatever it's been. He doesn't look good so far. Cionel Perez hasn't looked good so far. So there's still some question marks for me in the back end of that bullpen for sure.
Roger?
Well, that's the way the Phillies felt, that he was pretty much shot after losing the games in the playoffs. But, who knows? I mean, it's spring training. Things have a way of changing, and I think the Orioles have a great team. Doug, it just dawned on me. We had a great conversation with Jim Cott the first or second half hour, and he really gave us some insight. And you just mentioned about learning a cutter and all these other pitches. And we talked about the wear and tear on arms of young pitchers, youth.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, you talked about the speed too. I'm just wondering if having so much of a repertoire in your arsenal can also be one of the reasons for having so many young pitchers with Tommy John surgery.
The first and foremost, I think, the fundamentals of how to throw a baseball are certainly important. I also think that we live in a world that's metric driven, and everybody has a, in golf, everybody has their own launch monitor. Everybody has a radar gun, and they're you know, these pitchers are throwing, you know, 110% of what their velocity can be. And, you know, I don't know whether they're taking care of their arms in the off season. I mean, I can tell you, even in college when I played baseball as an outfielder, we threw a decent amount. I mean, certainly not like, you know, a pitcher would throw, but, you know, I was in the training room every day getting stretched, doing my, you know, shoulder exercises, and I would do dry heat before, and then after practice I would go in and I would ice and stretch and do my shoulder exercises. So, I mean, I tried to take care of my arm as much as possible, but, you know, you get these dum-dums. I mean, you know, Braden's 10, he'll be 11 this year, and there's no chance he's throwing any kind of a breaking ball. I don't care what it is. It's not a curveball. It's not a slider or a swerve or whatever the hell they come up with. You know, the first pitch you learn how to throw as an off-speed pitch is a changeup. And then if you want to throw a two-seam fastball, you want to throw a four-seam fastball, you know, maybe you do mess with the pressure on your fingers and you start fooling with cutters and stuff like that. So you get a little bit of movement, but there's no, you know, ill effects, if you will, to your elbow and, you know, that UCL. And, you know, even all the way up through, I mean, you got to pay attention to these kids and how many pitches they throw or how many innings they throw. I mean, you know, certainly winning doesn't come at the cost of, you know, the expense of a child or his arm, you know, right? So, yeah, there's a lot of factors. I mean, at the major league level, you see these guys that have, you know, four, five, six pitches. And, you know, I mean, you got to have command of some of those pitches, starting with your fastball. If you can't locate your fastball, then the rest of that stuff's no good anyway. So, you know, again, I think it goes back to that.
Well, it's interesting because every sport has a guru that can help. And Jim was talking twice, Johnny Sain helped him when he was coaching in Minnesota. It also helped him later on when he was coaching somewhere else. And just made some changes. He had worked with him, and after going, I forget, Roger, I think he said 4-something the year before, 4-6. When he got back with Johnny Sain the second time, he won 18, 21, and 27 games. And he said it was all based on Johnny Sain, you know, giving him things that he thought would help him be the pitcher he was before. And that's exactly what happened. Is you see it in golf all the time as a PGA professional. Sure. You see a little bit of something that somebody's not doing, whether it's putting, whether it's when they're short game, whatever it is. And you work with them and you bring them into a position where they could be that much more consistent. That's the story.
Well, I mean, look, that's, you know, you're relating that to, as you mentioned, the golf game. I mean, gosh, you know, there's how many people, more than 50%, will say, you know, they'll walk past the putting green, they'll walk past the chipping area, and they'll go right to the driving range and start wailing away at their driver. I mean, you know, everybody wants to see how far they can hit it. Everybody wants to know their ball speed, their club head speed, and all these metric-driven things. But at the end of the day, you know, on a good day, you're going to hit your driver 14 times, right? So what are you doing the rest of the time with, you know, your putter and your short game and all those things? So, you know, a lot of that's just the ego of people that want, you know. I mean, look at Jamie Moyer was one that, I mean, good Lord, he couldn't break a pane of glass, and he won how many games in his career? I mean, he was, you know, look at a lot of these guys that stuck around.
St. Joe's in Philly, Roger. Danny Moore.
That's right.
Out of St. Joseph's.
Yeah, absolutely. From up in the Allentown area, right? But
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
what? Don, that's a good point. But Jim also, the one that got me, Don, was when he talked about Whitey Ford. What Johnny Sain said to Ralph Houk, who's your best pitcher? And he was, what, 16 or won 14 or 16 games. And then he went from 5 days to 4 days rest, and that's when he won 20-some games.
Mm-hmm.
That really got me.
Well, he's very much just as Doug has been saying. He's very much on protecting, throwing the baseball as much as you can. Not necessarily, I'm talking about in between starts and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Not just sitting around, but throwing the baseball. And he was a great believer in that. That you know, working at it, it's a job.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to you know, give your arm the best chance to win, and that's the way he felt
sure.
you win.
And, you know, I mean, a lot of these guys, I mean, I guess the gold standard now is, can he throw north of 200 innings in a season? And, you know, it's like you talk about football with padded practices. I mean, the NFL has cracked. I mean, they only give you, what, 6 or 7 padded practices, and then, you know, they're doing that for what reason? So people don't get hurt, and then the majority of the injuries happen on non-contact right. and or, you know, we've lost the fundamentals of how to tackle somebody, and, you know, that looks like crap in the games, and, you know what I mean? So, I mean, go back to, you know, guys like Jimmy Johnson, who, you know, they were hard asses, and they, I mean, he had them in pads and hitting all the time. You know, I think, God, who was it? What was a, there was a linebacker
Buddy Ryan.
For the Ravens. I can't think of his name. God dang. I saw him at a golf tournament, and I was talking to him, and I said, you know, what was the difference when you went from the Ravens to the Dolphins? And he laughed, and I said, what's so funny? He said, well, playing for the Ravens was like Club Med, but when I went to play for Jimmy Johnson, he said, we were out there, you know, hitting and tackling and practicing and pads and all that all the time.
Try Buddy Ryan. Try Buddy
yeah.
Ryan.
Same
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, Buddy, the best.
You know, I mean, look, a lot of these things, when you see a pitcher, you know, it was like, who was it? You know, you guys are Phillies gurus. Cliff Lee, when they handed him the ball in the World Series for Game 7, and the reporter said, well, are you nervous? And he laughed, and they said, why, you know, what's so funny? He said, no. He goes, why would I be nervous? He said, I've been doing this all my life. I've been doing this all year. He said, in between starts, I do my running. I do my conditioning. I do my exercises. I throw my sides. I throw my bullpens. He goes, when it's time for me to get the ball, I'm ready because I've done my work. You know, so that's one of the things that I teach people in golf is, you know, if you don't do your homework and you stand over a golf ball, you're only thinking about maybe the bad things that are happening or could happen. And what you need to do is you need to embrace your pre-shot routine because that's what calms you. You know, that's what gets you ready to hit the shot. And if you can't do that, then, you know, of course you're going to have anxiety because you can't control the outcome.
Roger?
You know, have you ever had guys that you've worked with, but, you know, they played golf for strictly enjoyment, but that you looked at them that if they really got serious, I mean, they're serious, mm-hmm. but if they really got
right.
focused, they could make mm-hmm. it a career. Do you ever have anybody like that?
You know, it's a good question. I think that by and large, that's going to happen at the junior level. You know, when you see, you know, a certain talent level, but the work ethic maybe doesn't match or, the support from the parents maybe doesn't match, you know, and those are scenarios where, I mean, I've given lessons to kids, you know, that honestly, they weren't very good, let's say, just fundamentally, but they had one or two things mm-hmm. about their golf swing that you really couldn't teach anybody else. They just found a way to, you know, get the club into the right position, or they were unorthodox maybe, those sorts of things. But it was like I was telling Braden the other day, I said, you know, if you really want to be good at something, you got to be a gym rat, you know, and I say that in air quotes. So like you want to be a good baseball player. I mean, you know, my dad would tell you, I used to lay in my bed and throw the ball up, you know, and catch it. And, you know, we were playing basketball till 9, 10 o'clock at night in the driveway. We were playing wiffle ball. We were playing football. We were always doing something. And, you know, I used to, you know, probably this was pre-COVID, but say 35 to 45 years old for me, I'm a little north of that now, but I'd spend an hour or two each evening in the gym, you know, lifting weights and doing cardio and, you know, doing different things. If you really want to be good at something, you got to be a gym rat. You got to, you know, my college roommate walked around our dorm with a baseball in his hand the whole time. Like he'd go to class and he'd flip, you know, he'd flip the baseball to himself, working on his curveball grip or, you know, whatever, just stuff. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I know that when I teach, some of my days are pretty long, but I typically like to get there early and I'll stay late. And in between lessons, I'll go to the chipping green or the putting green, or you got to be around it. You can't just turn it on and turn it off. It's got to be something that the faucet's always on.
You can't.
But, and Roger, once again, we roll down the street and we'll turn it back over to our commander, who produces this show.
Have a great week, Doug.
You got it. Thank you, guys.
I want to thank everybody for such a great night. Great guests, great questions. So thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, these programs are brought
thank
to you.
Thank you, Commander. You're the best.
Thank you. Grateful appreciation of the men and women of the United States Armed Forces and men and women police and fire services. When you're out there and you see someone in uniform, please make sure that they know that you know they're there. These programs are dedicated to those who have lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Colcap, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazwitz, Sergeant Thomas Batinger, San Diego Officer Mike Henler, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, Sergeant Tom Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Department, Patrolman Charlie Condit, Tarpon Springs Police Department, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Sergeant James O'Connor, Philadelphia Police Department, Sergeant Chris LeVake, Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department, Lieutenant Mike Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Patrolman Anofo Crispin, Lakeland PD, Deputy Josh Meyer, Nassau County Sheriff's Department, Captain Matt Letourneau, Philadelphia Fire Department, Captain Chris Leach, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Arthur Hope, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Flakis, Wilmington Fire Department, Chief Al Hogel, Longwood Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Deputy Mike Hargrove, Pine Alice County Sheriff's Department, Trooper Chelsea Richards, Florida Highway Patrol, Trooper Joe Bullock, Colorado Highway Patrol, Trooper Zachary Ben, Florida Highway Patrol, Sergeant Chris Fitzgerald, Philadelphia Police Department, Philadelphia Sheriff's Department, and Sergeant Ramon Mendez, Philadelphia Police Department, Philadelphia Airport Police. My brothers and sisters, you may be 10-7 at this point in time, and sometime we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until the time may the rose rise up to meet you, may the winds be always at your back, may the rains fall softly on your fields, and the sun shine lightly on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your family always in the palm of his hands. Good night, God bless, and have a great week.
Shemalek ma'ilama, shemahezahilma, sona shenevoratfet, akuigegen ma'ilma.
Shame on it, my dear, my shame.
to 1999, county dispatch to 1999, county dispatch to 1999. All units be advised, 1999 is responding to his last emergency. And God bless his soul and all the souls of the faithful departed. Good night, Bob. We love you and we miss you.